This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com. Welcome to Harding Code. We are recording this live from Brad Wilson's house on October 28th, 2009. This week we've got Brad Wilson and Scott Densmore. We're going to talk a little bit about the differences between Mac versus Windows development and iPhone versus iPhone with MonoTouch. So, God, it's almost like you guys don't need an introduction, but we should probably do that anyway. And so I don't screw it up and miss something. Why don't you two guys tell a little bit about yourselves? Brad?
So I've been a software developer for, 16, 17 years. It's been primarily Windows stuff. I have had multiple Macs now in the last 5 years. When they sort of switched over to OS X and it became Unix, I became very interested because I did a lot of Unix stuff in college. So I have Macs at home and Windows PCs at work and kind of live in both worlds.
Okay, that's my turn now. Scott Densmore here. Been doing development for about 14 or 15 years. And because Brad is such an awesome guy, he decided to turn me on to these Mac thingies that I would never, ever touch before. So about, two or three years ago, I walked into the Codeplex room and I said, "Where'd you get this nice shiny silver computer?" And he goes, "Oh, this Mac?" He goes, "You need to get one." So I did. And since then, I've been kind of a fanboy, I guess you'd say, for the past two or three years. And as soon as I got one, I said, "Oh, well, how can I play with this thing and make it useful for me?" And start doing development on it, Xcode. Recently doing iPhone development with Xcode. And then they came out with this MonoTouch thing. So I thought I would give it a try. And that's me.
Groovy. So one of the reasons I wanted to have you guys on is because you're both accomplished .NET devs, but you also have been through the Coco boot camp at Big Nerd Ranch, which is taught by Aaron Hillegass. Did I get his name pronounced
right?
I think that's right.
Yeah, and I believe he was one of the original architects of AppKit and in that at Next Step, or was he just
Developer. Yeah, he was a developer.
He was a developer at Next Step. Yeah. So you kind of have an expert's view on both languages. So let's start with the elephant in the room as far as as Objective-C goes, and that's the wacky syntax. So some of it is, the thing that was hardest for me to adjust to is the named parameters, because that was the first time I had really encountered that, and the braces and the idea of sending messages instead of, really calling functions back and forth. So I didn't know if you guys wanted to talk a little bit about that and what it's like to transition between the two, or if it's just easy and people are whining.
It's probably easier than most people are used to, but it is a different syntax. And it's still a C-based language, but if you have experience with languages like Smalltalk, it does have a lot of similarities with Smalltalk. You can say there's a difference between passing messages and calling methods, but in the end of the day, it sort of ends up being the same thing under the hood. It's really just sort of language. The weirdness of the language is that it straddles both the statically typed world of C and the dynamically typed language of Objective-C, where, I still have types on parameters and such to methods, so I can say what I really want here is a string, right? So you wouldn't get something like that with Python or Ruby, you just get a parameter name. But you could also say this thing is an ID, which means I don't really know what this is, right? And I can just call stuff on it. I won't get any IntelliSense or whatever you'd call the Xcode equivalent.
Code sense,
yeah. So you won't get any of that, but you can just sort of dynamically call it. So in that way, it sort of feels like, declaring something as an ID in Objective-C is like the dynamic keyword in C# 4. Just, I don't know what this is, but, if I type .quack, you can give me a duck. It doesn't really matter what kind of duck as long as it can quack.
Well, the other thing that I liked about Objective-C when I first started was I found myself not writing null checks a lot because you can send messages to nil, and nil is the equivalent of null, would you say? Whereas nil is an object in Objective-C, isn't it? So it's actually a first class, or is it just null like C?
Well, there's both, right? I mean, null is, in the C vernacular, is still, the zero pointer, because the still is C underneath. But the nil object can receive messages, like most dynamic languages. You can do that with Ruby or Python. You can basically say, I'm going to send messages to that.
But I think the biggest thing you really come down to is, and I had the blog post this recently, is the difference of where languages started and how these things are due. Like most C-based languages, C#, Java, those things are all V-table based, whereas and they're very similar, but Objective-C has this kind of big hash table of, well, I, when you're talking about messages, I store, like, what's this, for lack of a better word, this delegate look like? Like, what does this message look like? What does this method look like? And you could think of it as doing runtime checks and things like that. And so it has this big hash table of all the things that, all the methods or all the messages you can pass to that object. And it goes, oh, well, does this thing have it? And if it does, well, it'll send it to it. And if it doesn't, well, it doesn't really care. It just goes off to the ether. And there's all kinds of interesting things you can do, because you can have stand-ins and different things that allow you to go, well, if this guy doesn't understand this message, I can pass it on to some other object that I know about and see if he knows about it and things like that.
Yeah, and that way, you know, if you ever look at a language, like, again, to bring up Ruby and Python, the couple that I know best, you know, the implementation of a class in Ruby is basically a hash table, right? It's you know, named delegates. So here's the name, and I'm going to call this thing. You call it a method, but you can call it a message, and here's an endpoint, and I have a method hanging off of there that I can associate with that, and you have, you know, this ability to say, what do I do when there's not one of those there, which is one of the very nice features that, you know, I miss a lot in C# from not having it.
Yeah, one of the code camps, I think it was one in Portland. Anyway, we were talking about Coca there, and one of the guys who was working on the new Ruby VM, who lives here in Seattle, I can't remember his name, Adrian something. Anyway, he made the point that Objective-C isn't really dynamically typed, it's dynamic dispatch. Instead, you know what type it is, but you don't know if it necessarily accepts the message that you want to send to it yet, until it looks it up, like in the hash table, like you were saying.
Well, Ruby's exactly the same way, right? It's not that there are no types in Ruby. It's that, you know, the classes, the type is considered, you know, important for the person who's creating the object, but not important for the person who's consuming it. Right. So you have the same thing, except because you have that C nature where every parameter to a method has a type associated with it in Objective-C, now you can sort of narrow it down where, you know, in a language like Ruby, where you don't have that information, you sort of rely on the documentation to tell you, yes, I'm sort of expecting you to pass maybe a string or even a URL object would be okay, or, you know, and things like that. So types still do come into it.
Can I ask one thing? When the whole talking about, you know, the dispatch kind of orientation and the whole messaging thing kind of reminds me of, you know, like the message loop in Windows, and the small bit I did of that a long time ago, you could get into spots where it was just difficult to debug because you're throwing a message out there and you're expecting it to be handled and it's not. And then, you know, like in the world of .NET, you know, the more static type, and you in general, you're doing less of that. I just wonder, is that a problem? And if so, are there ways of kind of debugging and seeing what's going on? Where'd my message go? Why didn't it get handled?
So that is something you can get into. Given the dynamic of nature of it, you can say, I'll send a message to anyone, and if it doesn't get handled, the runtime goes, well, that's fine, we'll just move on with life. You usually find those pretty fast, because you will expect something to happen and it won't happen, and it's pretty easy to find out where those things happen. It can be the same because there's an event loop that runs, and you have something that happens within that event loop, like you clicked a button and you expected it to respond to some message, but it didn't respond to that message. Well, it's because you didn't hook it up right, or you didn't do anything to have that, you know, event handler going on. Well, guess what? It's just like if you were doing in WinForms and you didn't have your event delegate. Same thing.
So one other thing, and I'm going to stretch here because it's been a while since I've looked at this, but I think every NS object has an ISA property. Or not even NS object, just Cocoa or Objective-C objects, has an ISA, which is almost like JavaScript prototype, where it points back to its, you know, it's a superclass.
So yeah, you can basically define, I mean, you could build an entire runtime of, like, this underneath the covers, it does this a lot, is, can I say, is this a type of object? Is this a B type of object? So you can figure out, you know, what I want to do with it. So if it's an A type of object, I could send a message to it of this type, and then I could be a B object, and I could send it a message of this type. So it has that same time of kind of runtime information that you can query on, just like a lot of the other languages that we have today.
So the other thing that I noticed about my at first glance was that, and I've heard this from other people, like Will Shipley and people that do hardcore, like Cocoa and Objective-C development is, that Cocoa only goes so far, and then suddenly you're back into C land, and you're calling the, you're calling either Carbon APIs or, you know, just, you know, really weird things and passing around structs. And I thought it was interesting that, and I wish, hopefully we can find this blog post, but one of the, oh, one of the Apple devs had a post about how they were able to pass like C strings and convert them to Cocoa strings and, or S strings and back and forth without incurring much of a hit and it being really transparent to the dev. But so I was wondering if, so obviously that they've tried to cover as much as possible. And I remember the particular pain points were around the QuickTime API that, you know, once you get into QuickTime land, that you're back to, you know, just writing C code basically. And I was wondering if you find yourself running into that a lot in like normal Cocoa development, or if that's an extreme case where you're doing something really wacky.
So I follow a lot of people now, being a fanboy around people who do a lot of Cocoa development. And one thing that I have learned is, just like you said, to be a great Cocoa developer, you've got to be a really good C developer. I find myself typing less and less and less C and more Cocoa as the platform kind of moves along. Back in, you know, 2-3 years ago, there's probably more C than there is today. And it is true. They've done a great job with a platform of what they call bridging. So you can take an NS string and pass it down to a Carbon API, and it just basically handles it for you. They try to make it as seamless as possible so that you don't end up having to go, well, you know, I've got to figure out how to turn an NS string into an array of cars so that I can pass it off to this Carbon API, and then I have to get that array of cars, and then I have to turn it back into an NS string, and I have to deal with, okay, well, I got to release my NS, my, yeah, God only knows. Nobody wants to do that. You know, that's the part I don't ever want to miss.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned QuickTime because, you know, QuickTime 10 just came out with Snow Leopard. And this is one of those APIs that they finally converted over to Cocoa because, you know, the big change to 64-bit, they basically said, okay, 64-bit is for Cocoa only. There's no 64-bit Carbon anymore. We were going to do it, and then we changed our mind. So you'll see, I think, you know, over time, a lot of that stuff ends up getting replaced. You know, the graphics APIs basically all got overhauled. The database API got introduced, and it's less C than you have to worry about, you know, as time goes on. But the weird one is memory management in Cocoa is just kind of bizarre, fragmented, because it's not only C and Objective-C, but it's also Objective-C with garbage collection or not. Or if you're writing an API, you might have to write your codes that actually works in both cases, garbage collection and not. Because on the Mac, you have garbage collection. On the iPhone, you don't. You know, you have garbage collection on Leopard. You don't have garbage collection on Tiger. So it depends on what version of your app you're targeting. And the memory stuff in Objective-C is a lot like COM in that it's like an ad-ref release kind of a system. But they have this really cool sort of they have like an auto-release. And anything that you get that you didn't get from a function that has the word alloc in it, you just assume is going to be released for you at the end of your method. But if you get something from an alloc, then that means that you own that and you have to release it. So it's a lot less painful than, you know, when people think about reference counting in COM days, that was very painful. Really only made usable by C++ libraries with auto-release C++ classes.
Yeah, and I would have to admit that Cocoa is also a very convention-based language. That's another reason people get very confused by it. So if you go to Ruby from a statically typed .NET language, you would get very confused on, well, where does this go? Or how do I do something? Or if you've done any Rails work, and of course now MVC has these, carries a lot of these conventions, but, you know, controllers go in a controllers folder, views go in a views folder, model goes in a model folder. Well, Objective-C and Cocoa itself has a lot of these, just like Brad was mentioning, that like if I'm going to alloc init something, that means I have to release it. If I'm in an event loop and I didn't do something, I probably, which you're mostly all the time in an event loop, it's going to be auto-released. And if you want something, return something from a function, you don't have to worry about it. You just return it as auto-release because that's the convention. And once you learn the conventions, it becomes a lot easier to deal with this crazy kind of syntax of, oh, well, I have to put brackets around things and I have to call alloc init. There's no new. And you start understanding why these things happen the way they do.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. What's it like to live in pointer land versus... You know, go back, you know, it feels like, you know, back to the future almost, where, you know, iPhone is the new thing, but there's no garbage collection on the iPhone. So you're back to, you know, ref counting. And yeah, you get the auto release pool, but, you know, they put that zombie bit in there for a reason. So you know, sometimes, you know, you don't always get auto released right. And especially because the tooling, in my opinion, didn't help you out a lot with that. You know, the way that I always saw people using Xcode, they could have been using Vim or Emacs or anything else. There wasn't a lot of IDE assist, and that's something that's way different from being in a Microsoft world where you expect the IDE to hold your hand, kind of, and, you know, give you the correct IntelliSense instead of just giving you a list of anything that could possibly be called on that thing and other things like that. So what's it like having to manage your own memory, or is it really as painful as anyone else, you know, as anyone thinks? Or because I recently they had the Stack Overflow Dev Days, they had Roy Blythe presenting, and he was on a podcast with Hanselman and the Stack Overflow podcast, and they were kind of talking about Objective-C dev and Cocoa stuff, and that was one of the things that he pointed out was, you know, just kind of horrible, but they kind of liked it. They kind of thought it was cool because then it was hard, you know. It was more fun because, you know, you had to worry about things. You could do pointer arithmetic, whereas you don't really get to do that kind of stuff anymore in C#ville.
Well, I would say you can do those things in C#ville because they absolutely let you do it. Not necessarily that you would want to. But I find it's not as hard as people make it out to be. Again, it's about a convention. If you understand the conventions, it's actually really easy to find those things. And one of the blog posts bloggers that I read all the time is Matt Gallagher, and Coco's my girlfriend. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. And he has a great set of resources of going, oh, well, here's how you can, you know, figure out these conventions. And once you figure them out, again, there's not that many of them. It's pretty easy to live in that pointer land, but you're not actually living in is a pointer land that is, oh, I have to remember to call delete or anything. It's, I call, you know, if I alloc something, I release something. And if it's auto released, I don't really have to worry about as much.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say, after playing around with Objective-C and seeing how it interfaces into the old Carbon APIs and C stuff, I mean, I don't want to sound like a shill here, but, you know, PInvoke and .NET is just so brilliant. You know, and IJW and Managed C++ is just so brilliant compared to what's in Objective-C. It is very painful when you have to make that transition in Objective-C, and it's not as bad. And, you know, again, you're talking about Xcode being just like a glorified Emacs. Again, Visual Studio, totally awesome. But, you know, it would be nice to be able to get that level of tooling for people who are doing other stuff, doing iPhone apps. I mean, you know, being able to do like an iPhone app with Monotouch and Visual Studio would be absolutely killer, I think.
And I think I've been playing with Xcode since, I think, 2.0, 2.1 or something like that. And they have, when I first got into it, I said, oh, this is Visual C++ 1.5. I was like, this seems like I'm living in an editor from the late 90s. And of course, Cocoa was built around the early 90s. So it's been around for a long time. And it seems like Xcode's been living there since then. But with the new Snow Leopard and new Xcode, it's got some amazing new features. I mean, they've moved the thing tremendously, and I think they've done a great job with it. I think they've got a long way to go to catch up with something like Visual Studio, but I think one of the features that is less thought about is the integration between Interface Builder and Xcode, and I think they really got that right. I mean, the way that WinForms done or Silverlight or any of those other things are done is just kind of backwards to me now. Broken. They were always kind of broken, but the way they do Model View Controller and that's just a first-class citizen of Cocoa. It is an amazing thing, and I love the integration between Interface Builder and how I can kind of do, a lot of people get weirded out by this, but drag things around and set up outlets and actions and do those things that now seem kind of second nature, and they are kind of weird to get used to, but they just make sense, and it's a much easier flow to build an application that way rather than what we get, I think, in the Visual Studio stack.
Well, and that was kind of my impression of IB as well, was that before, like, VS 2005 or 2008, where they kind of kicked the designer up a little bit, the Interface Builder GUI was so much better than the WinForms designer, as far as helping you line things up and getting things, you know, set up and conforming to the human interface guidelines that Apple always breaks every version, but I guess they can because they're the vendor. but it seemed a lot more natural once I learned about outlets and actions and whatnot to wire it up that way and then just have it generate like my header files and everything that I needed. And then to go back into Xcode and work from there. So I kind of did the interface first and then I worked backwards whenever I was playing around with it.
So that's something that throws me a little bit, because in the .NET, you know, like in the whole WPF and Silverlight world, there's a lot of pushback from developers on adopting Blend. And you know, to me, like, I like the idea of having, you know, Visual Studio is primarily for coding and Blend is primarily for UI design and interaction design. And it kind of makes sense to me, but it does take some time to learn it. And but so it sounds like in the Mac world, Interface Builder, it's okay to do, but in the .NET world, people don't want to learn to do it. Is that just because historically you didn't have to, or are there some big differences between how Interface Builder works and how Blend works?
Well, I think and again, this is, Interface Builder is all about the interface. I mean, if you've looked at, kind of mixing genre here, but if you've looked at Monotouch, it allows you to define a lot of your actions and outlets inside of Interface Builder that then get defined, kind of put into in a WinFormish way, kind of a designer file behind the scenes. But by default, you can do it either way in Interface Builder and or Xcode. You can start out building all your actions and outlets in Xcode and then hook those up into Interface Builder, or you can just start purely at Interface Builder. And one of the things that you can do with Interface, that the great thing about Interface Builder and those nibs is it makes it a lot easier to kind of do localization of things within your application, given that it's just a big XML kind of and freeze-dried objects inside your zip files.
Oh, Kevin, you have a question or a statement or something to say?
One of the hot topics in the whole WPF Blend Silverlight world is this sort of designer developer workflow, you know, where there's the designer tools, which, you know, whether they're actually targeted at designers or not is kind of a bone of contention, and the development tools. And I don't really hear that sort of discussion, not that I'm in the Mac development community, but I don't know, from the brief contact I have, it doesn't seem like that's like a big thing there, even though, you know, UX is such a hot topic. I mean, it's, you know, UX is much more part of the culture of the Mac than it is in the Windows development world. I'm just curious if you guys have an opinion on why that is, or, you know, am I missing? Is there something I'm not seeing in the Mac development community?
I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. People are very passionate about the UI when it comes to the Mac. I mean, the look and feel is something they start out with. So depending on what kind of stylish programmer you are, is where you start within your kind of, whether you start with your controller first and you're doing everything in your controller, and, or you're actually modeling out your UI. And the actual UI within Interface Builder allows you to build some very incredible UIs, because a lot of that's all built with what's in Cocoa. So Apple uses Cocoa to build everything. Well, everything that's in Cocoa is there for you to build your own UI. I mean, you can make some crappy UI. I've seen some very crappy ones on Mac, but most of the time people are very interested in doing some crazy stuff with UIs. I mean, if you look at Will Shipley and his Delicious Library, it looks like a library. I mean, that's one of his guidelines. So I'm going to make this look like a library, and I'm going to make it very easy for people to use. And most of the great developers on the Mac, that's what they do.
I remember when the very first Intel Macs were coming out, and Parallels was making the first virtual machine software for Intel Macs. And one of the complaints they got constantly in the forums from the users was, this doesn't look like a Mac app. I don't know what kind of apps you guys are used to writing, but this looks like crap. And if you don't fix it, we're not buying it. That's hilarious. These guys are, you know, making it so you can run Windows on the Mac, and these guys are like, yeah, but if the button isn't the right height according to the guides and the toolbar isn't correctly laid out, well, then screw you. I'm not buying it.
Well, I always remember the posts every time there's a new iTunes rev. I think it's Gruber that goes through, and he'll talk about, you know, exactly how the gradient is done at the top and how it's changed, and this border, you know, this one pixel border is now different, and then now the window is borderless on the sides, and I'm like, really? I never noticed that. And I don't know if that's just being desensitized or growing up on Commodore 64s where, you know, that just wasn't possible.
Load **, *8, 1.
See, that's usability right there, damn it. Always comes back to the command line interface. So let's see what else. We covered IB. We've covered Xcode mostly. We could talk about Ztrace and how awesome that is, but is it Ztrace? Is that what it's called? Or
Ztrace.
Maybe Ztrace is what it was called at Sun, or was it called?
I think it was the one they stole and renamed is Ztrace.
Yeah. No, I don't know if they licensed it or it was open source, but anyway, because I've never used Ztrace, but people that I know that love it, you know, just love it. It's awesome.
I like instruments. I think it's a much easier interface than going to the command line and trying to figure out what went wrong. But
yeah, absolutely. So the other thing I thought we might talk about is ADO.NET versus Core Data. So one of the things that I noticed was there wasn't any way to save any damn things in the Objective-C and Cocoa that I was working with. There were some serializers, you know, and I think the Hillegas book, you know, talks about, you know, binary serialization, saving it to the disk instead of, you know, having a kind of a database. And I remember when SQLite support came out in Core Data, and everyone just went bonkers because they could finally, you know, do actual SQL statements against data. And even then, it wasn't very obvious, at least to me, coming from the ADO.NET and ADO kind of world, where, you know, you used to, you know, set up the connection, you make the connection, you get record sets, you get rows, you get things like that back. And it was all just very different. It all tied in with the key value binding, which I thought was really, really cool. But it still took a little bit for me to, took me a little bit of while to figure out how to do that, just because of some of the conventions in Interface Builder, like the names didn't make sense, how you would select and bind against collections, and they weren't really collections. They were called something weird, and how you would say, oh, I want that one. And I remember I never did figure out how to reload when an app starts up. I never did figure out how to go and get the last record that I was looking at. and that may just be me, and it probably just is. It is. But I remember I scoured forums, news groups, mailing lists everywhere, and I never saw an answer to that specific problem. Like, I stopped on row 18 in my data source. When the app starts back up, I should be on that row in the UI.
Sounds like you had a lot of fun with Core Data. Core Data is a fairly new technology, I mean, altogether. And the SQLite support is definitely a new thing. I wish I could remember the guy's name, Zaris, I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but the tagline is, his tagline on his blog is, "Taglines are for Windows programmers." So he's a great Core Data guy. He just wrote a book with Pragmatic Programmers and has a great book on Core Data. But Core Data, to me, reminds a lot of InHibernate. So you have this NS managed object context, and you can, it's kind of like the session in session context, and you get an init, and you can get a bunch of NS managed objects from it. And of course, they have their own designer that allows you to create objects that can be typed objects, or you can just deal with this little NS managed object that is untyped. And it's kind of, that's why I think a lot of people, it feels this kind of weird thing. You mean I got back an object from my ADO.NET record set, and now I'm going to do something with that object and keep going. And Core Data is really just a wrapper over a way to store data as XML, a SQLite database, or a plist. I mean, it has the three plugins. I've never seen anybody, I don't know if you can actually write a plugin. I don't think you can for another one, but you can get into, okay, so I can store my stuff as XML, which you never want to ship anything that does that. I can store it. I can store it in SQLite. So one of the interesting things about, of Core Data is it's not really a database. So you can, it's really more for your desktop or for storing applications on your phone or your iTouch or something. Because I think that it was when I went to the Big Nerd Ranch that I heard this, that Steve Jobs hates the enterprise. So he doesn't, he's not interested in having this big, you know, big framework of enterprise objects that he can go out and talk to PostgreSQL or MySQL or SQL Server or Oracle or whatever. So that's the kind of thing that that you get with Core Data.
Yeah, those were the two things that I remember trying to do in this app. It was going to be a pretty simple app. You were going to enter in data, and then it was going to chart it. so like the two things that you can't. I thought, well, you know, I'll set up MySQL and I'll store it in MySQL. No, because then you're back into C land, and you know, you're basically just bringing in the headers and you're just writing against the MySQL C headers. And you know, then I thought, well, I can at least chart it if I can figure out Core Data. Well, no, there's no official supported charting framework or API in Cocoa. Those are the two. I found one out there that was written at a university, but I could never figure out how to get it working because like you had to import the toolkit or something. It was the way it was packaged up, I had to import it, and I never did quite figure that out. There was a lot of things I didn't quite ever figure out. And I got to the point where I felt like I couldn't work anymore in this app, and I started to do it in Adobe Air because at least I had charting APIs at some point. Has any of that changed in Snow Leopard? Is there
the things that have changed in Snow Leopard are And I think they've been around since Leopard. It's core data. It still now can support those three formats in the SQLite, and you don't really have to go against the C SQL API, which you had to do. Even iPhone, the 3.0 supports core data now. Before, you know, iPhone 2 and iPhone 1 first generation, you really couldn't do anything but go SQL, you know, go to the straight C API for SQLite. Charting wise, not a whole lot still out there, but there actually is. I will have to admit, there are a lot more open source projects around, given the iPhone's popularity now, around Objective-C and Cocoa, and a lot of the things that go on there allow you to do both Cocoa and Cocoa Touch. So things on the Mac, things on the phone, iPhone or iTouch.
John, did you have something to ask?
I did. So you mentioned the you know, three different things you can store things in, and you mentioned plist, so I wondered if you guys could explain a little bit about that, because that's a Mac thing that Windowsy guys don't even are they're a little scared. I'm scared of. So
I would consider it a bastardized version of XML. If you've ever opened your iTunes, so if you ever tried to move your iTunes folder before they allow you to move your iTunes folder, and you ever opened up that big huge what's looked like an XML file, it's just a bunch of name value pairs. And I think it was kind of a way to have XML before they had XML, because plist has been around a long time. But it looks like a bastardized version of XML, and it's name value pairs. And if you ever want to move your iTunes that's not there anymore, you can go open up that file and look at it, and that is a plist file.
You can sort of think of it like little portable registries for your applications. It's usually store your preferences in these things.
INI files?
Yeah, kind of like that. Except, you know, no structure, really. It's really just literally name value pairs.
So, I mean, in that way, that's kind of like my understanding of what JSON is, right? Because that's object notation, and in JavaScript, each object it's an associative array. Does it have some structure like that, or is it even less structured?
It does have some structure. Like, you can store NS dictionaries in there, and so so you can have hierarchies of name value pairs within it. So you get something very similar to, I would assume, JSON. I'm not a JSON expert. And I don't even play one on TV, but you can get something that's very similar to that, where you could, again, serialize your object down. It could be a set of a name value pair arrays that could go into this plist so that you could then read it back in later.
I got to ask, do you guys just get tired of saying NS everything?
So the actual thing, that's actually a funny thing, because NS is actually a convention. So there's no namespacing in Objective-C. So NS stands for next step, which is where, you know, Steve Jobs had the next step company after Apple kicked him out, and Apple tried to build a new OS and said, oh, we didn't really quite do it. Come back, Steve, and give us OS 10. So NS stands for next step. So one of the conventions is, when you create your classes, you should name them something that's similar to what you have as a company. So if you were to, like, if for Microsoft, if they were able to build some kind of Cocoa objects, then they should probably have MS instead of NS.
So I'm curious, you mentioned plist as kind of a way of storing, you know, things for installations, like here's my iTunes list or whatever. And so, like, I know on Mac, you've got kind of the magic thing where, like, installation is you just drop it from one folder into the other, and then it's magically there. But behind the scenes, is that just all kind of stored in one folder? I mean, what's the, and if so, is that good or bad? Because I know, like, on Linux, you can have some difficulty with knowing what's installed on the machine. Like, you know, do I have access to this API, or has the user installed this windowing system, or that kind
of
thing?
So for application deployments, the Mac has this sort of a weird convention that, if from the Finder experience, the Finder is like the equivalent of Windows Explorer. From the Finder experience, an application looks like a single file, even though the thing you're looking at is actually a directory with a bunch of stuff in it. And so when you download a virtual disk image and you mount it on the Mac and you grab the application, you drag it into your application folder, what you're actually doing is copying a whole directory full of stuff, even though it looks like one thing to you. And then it'll store, like, the plist, your configuration stuff, it'll store that in your own private directory, your user directory, basically. I really only have sort of app experience. I've never really written any APIs, so I'm not sure what the answer to that one is.
So what they call that is a bundle. So, and yes, that's NS bundle. But when you have these applications, you get a bundle. And of course, you have, it's very similar to, like, okay, here's my application. I have a bundle, and I have a bunch of stuff in it. So I'm going to have all my content, my PNG files, I have my plist file, I have my actual executable files, and I have my icon that looks like I only have one file in my Finder. So if you ever, in a Mac, you can say, take one of those applications, say right-click, show, and it'll say show contents. And you'll open it up and you'll see all kinds of interesting things inside of that. So, and that bundle allows you to go, here's my kind of directory where everything is so that I can load. So if I wanted to load a zip file that's not in my current bundle directory, I could load it from a plugin directory that's outside of my bundle. But I can at least say, I know where my bundle is because it's sitting, you know, right here with my application.
Right. So, but like now let's say, how do I check on a computer to see if iTunes is installed, for instance?
Oh, so you're talking about, like, how do I find if an application is installed on my computer? Sort of the registry type thing. That's a good question, because I haven't actually had to do any of that stuff, so I don't know a whole lot about that. But I know there are APIs to go looking around the file system, and you can actually see everything has a kind of, you have an application library folder that has a bunch of stuff that goes with each application. And I think, given the convention of things, you would have to go look for iTunes.
Yeah, I was going to say that, I mean, since it's all header file based, it all gets statically linked. So, you know, if it's not installed, you just get some kind of an, you know, error, I guess, when it runs. I never saw any example code for, you know, checking to see what's installed. But I do know there's two separate folders, I think, that are conventionally where preferences are stored. There's like a library folder, and then there's, I want to say user, but that's not right.
There's a library folder in your user folder, and there's an actual user folder. It's just,
yeah,
like anything else.
Global one,
yeah. Yeah, global one.
But then there's also another folder besides library where, like, Mozilla, I think, stores its preferences. What am I thinking of? Applications in library, I think. Yeah. Oh, just library? That's the only place? We're looking at Scott's Mac. I'm the only loser here without a Mac on the podcast.
The only other thing is probably application support within the library. But library is where everything is stored, yeah, for every application and all your user preferences for your user or for globally on the machine.
Because I remember Scott Reynolds had a blog post about installing two versions of Mozilla on your Mac, and he said you can just put it in a separate folder. And I thought, well, I think the profile and everything is stored in the same location in the library, so it might not work as well if there's differences between the profiles between versions.
Well, the profiles usually have the version associated with them, probably, so that you can say, you know, like it's got com.mozilla.firefox.3.5 instead of, you know, 3.0, so that when it gets stored in that application support folder, it would not overwrite the next one, because you can have, you know, as many as you want installed because of those little bundles that are just drug around everywhere. You can have multiple installed on all your machines. Right. When I first installed my first application from a DMG file, I was running it from the DMG file because I didn't understand. You had to drag it over to the application folder. And I was like, I don't understand this whole dragging of applications. Where's my MSI?
Yeah, some of them actually put a little shortcut to the applications folder in the image itself. So when you open it up, there's like the icon, and then there's a little arrow pointing it to the app folder. Like, just drag it over here. And I think there's three ways to install actually on a Mac. So everyone talks about the drag and drop and just drag the bundle in. But there's also a package format, which is more like their traditional, you know, MSI or what am I trying to think of? Next finish installer. Those always scared me because when you do a bundle install, if you want to uninstall it, you just drag it to the trash. You know, and you might leave behind some cruft in the library, but there was an app called AppZapper that would do kind of a simple string search and find all those directories and zap them as well. But the package ones, they like put a receipt somewhere and you had to run the package again and uninstall it. And that meant leaving behind, you know, 500 meg install somewhere in your drive. And at the time I only had a 20 gig hard drive, so I was concerned about that. So somewhere I have DVDs and DVDs and DVDs of package files if I ever need to uninstall or install again.
You tend to see the older style Carbon applications using the package stuff. You also see, you know, very large applications that do customized installs. So, like, I've, you know, Adobe Creative Suite, I have Microsoft Office, both of those are package style installers, but pretty much everything else I use is a bundle because you're just downloading a small app and you just use it. So it's not that onerous, I don't think.
So let's see. What have we not covered?
I had one quick question too, which is just as far as graphics. I know you asked Scott K about graphing, but in general, like, is drawing just, is it pretty low level? You're writing pixels on the screen, or is it a pretty good windowing, you know, graphics system?
So the answer is yes and no. it's not as bad as it used to be. The core animation is basically the way you draw on a screen, and you get the great, cool-looking bouncing icons and crazy, you know, moving windows around and moving icons around on the screen and, you know, all those different things. But core animation is pretty much a Coco style. It's a C-style API because, but since with the bridging, you can pass in a strings in it and do whatever you want to, and it's a lot of structs, so it's very C-oriented. But they have made it a lot simpler. So I can have a layer. And again, these are a core animation layer. So everything within your view is kind of got a layer. You can put layers on top of layers upon top of layers and draw different animations on top of these layers and move them around. And as you move them around and as you move different things on top of layers, you can swap layers in and out. And it's actually an amazing, cool little API that makes it pretty easy to build interesting kind of graphs that the things that you download now, the graphing chart that's Scott K was talking about, you can actually do now with core animation pretty easily.
Okay, so let's get into the other kind of half of the Mac development, which is the tiny Mac, the iPhone development. So 100,000 app developers can't be wrong necessarily. So
yes,
it can't.
You're hanging out with smart people. That's cool.
Have you seen the half the apps on iTunes?
Yeah. Yes. I've heard about those. That's another thing. So there's quality, but the fact that they're able to get that far means that it can't be all that god-awful hard. I mean, if they can, you know, wake up, wipe the drool off their chin, slap the keyboard, and put an app in the App Store and get it through the approval process, then, you know, there's hope for Windows developers is kind of my point there. So kind of compare and contrast, because I've seen some demos on Monotech, and it looks like you can still use Interface Builder to some extent, at least to do the nib files, because there's no designer yet for Monotouch. I think they're going to put out a kick-ass XAML designer before they put in a nib file designer first. But for the most part, I mean, so that part looked kind of familiar to me. It was like, oh, yeah, you're just wiring up outlets and actions. And, you know, and the interesting part to me was I saw your blog post on the Hello World kind of app and seeing how you declared those in C# versus the way that you do it in Coco. And it looked like it was a little bit more verbose in C#, but it seemed like it was easier for me to understand. And there might have been a little less code overall.
Yeah, the funny thing is, you know, I think a lot of the iPhone developers are not what you would call traditional C# developer or Java developer. I think a lot of the applications that are in the iPhone store end up being from first-time developers. And actually not having the baggage of, you know, a statically typed language like C#, getting a book like Aaron's Coco book, you know, it's not hard in a week to learn this stuff. It's really not all that challenging. I mean, the language is sort of the biggest barrier. And if you don't have sort of preconceived notions about how you program a language, then you're just following along. And it doesn't take long for you to figure out how to get all this stuff to go. And of course, Interface Builder helps, although not as much on the iPhone as on the Mac. But, you know, I am actually impressed at the quality of the applications. I mean, there's a lot of bad applications, but, you know, percentage-wise, there's probably a lot more bad applications on Windows than there are on the Mac or the iPhone.
Yeah, there was an interview with one of the Adium, the little instant messenger for Mac. Interview with one of the contributors and one of the project managers for it. And before he started contributing to the project, he wasn't a programmer. He just, you know, so he came in with absolutely no preconceived notions about how screwed up Objective-C was, and he just learned it and worked on it and then added in his own features and gradually, you know, kind of worked his way up or took over the project. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing with Objective-C is people see the dollar signs in iPhone development and they're like, how hard can it be? You know, all these autistic nerds learn it. I ought to be able to do this, right?
So the one thing I kind of took some of the, I guess, the Hello World, the RSS reader, and set in one of the blog posts I did recently was, how can I take this and turn this into Objective-C, which is the complete opposite of what they were trying to do. They're going to take something that was written in Objective-C, and I'll turn it into C# and those type of things. And I think the interesting things it comes down to, again, it comes down to language. It's all about whether I'm using C# or whether I'm using Objective-C. Anybody that's done C# for the past 5 years, of course, the C# is going to go, oh, well, that's very interesting. I can read that. I know what that is. But underneath the covers, you're still using the same thing. I'm using a UI table view controller.
I'm going to have a UI table source or UI table view source, data source, and a UI table view delegate. And I'm going to have to, you know, I'm going to have to hook up Interface Builder because they do have, you know, I'm absolutely thrilled that they have Interface Builder still. I think trying to do something else. And again, I know they're going to try to move this to other platforms, but for the iPhone, there's really no other platform. Trying to do something different would probably make not a whole lot of sense. I actually wish they would have invested some time in making it work in Xcode. You know, C# and Xcode would have been kind of cool to have that thing. But, you know, the language doesn't really give you a whole lot of benefit except when it comes, like, for example, when I did the RS reader, guy had an XML document. No such thing as there's an XML parser that's more Sax-based, but no such thing on the iPhone, except you can go download an open source one and they have the same thing. So you can go download that. I could have done the same thing, but I said, oh, I'll just build a parser. I'll make a class. I'll have it do its thing and build a delegate, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of the same conventions apply in the C# world as they do in the Objective-C world. But the interesting thing is, like, when I first started looking at it, I found it very odd. So coming from the Objective-C world, looking at the C#, I was going, wow, why do I have to have an extra class for my delegate? I could just usually put that as, Objective-C, they have protocols, which are very similar to interfaces. Of course, differently, that you don't have to actually implement all the methods on the interface because they're optional if you make them. I was like, wow, I have to have this extra class to be my data source, and I have to have this extra class to be my delegate, where I could usually just annotate my controller with this protocol that says, you know, you have table view delegate, you have table view data source, and bam, I'm done. So a little bit different. Again, language difference, but those type of things, again, I think Roy said it on Twitter the other day, pick your language, have fun with it.
I thought that protocols were more like extension methods in C#, but there's another way that you can... There's a way that you can add methods to an Objective-C class without having to go in and modify it. And I thought those were protocols, but is that something different?
It's something completely different. Yeah. So you can actually go in and extend a class, an open class, and why I can't remember. Oh, now that you've asked me, I can't remember. I could have told you if you'd asked me. It's all your fault. But you can go and extend a class. Now, you can't access members of the class that you're extending. So it's very similar to extension methods, but they're not like the extension methods where you write another class. You basically create a class and say, oh, well, here's a class in a string, and I'm going to add some methods to in a string because I want to. And then you extend the in-a-string class, and you call it in-a-string. The kind of convention is in-a-string plus string helpers. Categories, yes. Categories. Thank you, Google. Bing or whatever.
Yeah, it's Google. Google. There's no Bing here. Yeah, so categories is what I was thinking of in my age-addled head.
Let's talk. Protocols are actually pretty cool. Scott mentioned they're like interfaces in the sense that you can define them and you can say, I want to use something that conforms to this protocol. So it should have these two methods. But you declare this protocol, and any object that obeys it by having those methods actually is seen to be implementing that protocol, even though that object knew nothing about that protocol when it was written. So it's like, I want iDuck, right? And I put quack on there. And in .NET, they're like, oh, well, I have to go back and modify all the objects that have quack on it and add iDuck now so that I know that they are. But protocols, you don't have to do that. That's a really cool language feature.
So you could say it's kind of like a managed extensibility framework that has been around for a while.
Shot.
Not that we're saying it is. We're just saying it seems like.
You might call it that. You could also, you know, call it all kinds of things. You could also put a lot of things in the managed extensibility framework bucket. But, you know, he's actually right. The kind of thing that you can do with protocols, and again, you can't do this. And again, that's why they have them as base classes. Like, more of the interesting thing I went around is going, well, why did they pick this way of implementing it in C#? Well, why did they pick it to be a base class, you know, this thing? Oh, it's because they're all optional. So you have to make them all virtual that you have to override if you want to do them, but you don't have to actually do anything with them. So it's an interesting kind of look on, understanding, you know, kind of taking this dynamic type Objective-C language and then trying to go, well, how am I going to take this thing that's built one way and go build it with a statically typed language and make it work?
Yeah, it's stuff like that that makes me think that the Mono team are just like, I don't know, they're on a different level. not only are they beating the .NET, you know, framework guys out for features, you know. I think at Alt.NET Seattle, we showed Miguel de Acasa the T4 templates for the first time ever, and like 2 weeks later, they're in Mono. It's like if they can dream it, they can do it. And that was the first thing that I thought was when I saw the post was, you know, knowing what those methods probably looked like in Objective-C and to make them look C-sharpish so that you didn't have to, you know, because when you're doing like office interop, you know, you end up passing in like 50 null parameters and then the one Boolean that you want. And I could have seen that kind of thing happening in Objective-C where, you know, C-sharp just, you know, and Mono just wouldn't know how to deal with the fact that everything's kind of optional and nil can take a message and it can be null and it's okay. And, you know, you're just having to do all this really wacky, you know, gymnastics. But they made it so that you're basically writing C-sharp code and you don't even notice that. You know, unless you start to notice things like, why do I have a separate, you know, class for this delegate? Why do I have to do it like this? You know, and that's just an artifact of, you know, the Cocoa classes. But for the most part, you're just, you know, you're writing C-sharp code and it looked kind of natural. And, you know, that's kind of hard to do when you, especially if you've ever tried to do anything with like the WX widgets or any of the kind of the cross-platform UI widget libraries, you know, you end up doing lots of weird things. Qt also comes to mind where you're like, well, I shouldn't have to do that on, you know, Objective-C or Cocoa, or I don't have to do that in WinForms. Why do I have to do that in Qt? So, Kevin.
Well, just to go back to the Mono Touch versus Objective-C question, you know, the two aspects of it are familiarity and productivity, right? Like, you can use MonoTouch because you're familiar with, you know, .NET and you know C#. And one of the other arguments is, well, it's a more productive language. It has these really rich class libraries. It has, garbage collection. So from your guys' perspective, you know, how big are those two issues? I mean, is it really more about familiarity, or is the productivity of MonoTouch really, you know, compelling? Assuming you already know Objective-C.
Well, if you already know Objective-C, then MonoTouch is kind of a waste, in my opinion. Scott Densmore has worked more with it than me, but, you know, anytime you go to a platform, the language is so unimportant compared to the platform itself. And so MonoTouch is going to bring some of the, it's going to bring some of the .NET platform, but the things that you need to know and learn, like about Cocoa Touch, it's not going to invalidate your need to learn that stuff. And so, you know, worrying about the Objective-C versus the C# stuff seems to me like a minor bit compared to learning how to write an application with Cocoa Touch, whether you're doing it in Objective-C or C#.
And I have to absolutely agree with that. I mean, if you're familiar with C#, and I think the biggest thing comes down to me, and I'll call the white elephant in the room, is the $500 price tag that they put on it.
Quick correction here. The MonoTouch guys got a hold of me after the podcast came out and reminded me that the cost is $399, not $500. There's also an eval version that lets you develop against a simulator, although you can't deploy to an iPhone with it.
If it wasn't for the $500 price tag, I would probably go, oh, if I could build my app and I could be more productive with it, man, I'd be on top of that. No dice. I'd just go right after it. But, you know, language feature aside, I mean, you're going to have to learn how Cocoa works. You're going to have to learn what it means to kind of do things the way that kind of Apple has had these conventions of doing within the iPhone. I mean, if you're familiar with Model View Controller, well, this whole idea of setting up actions and actions and outlets within Interface Builder and then tying them back over to your codes that you can talk to them, it's not a huge difference. And again, if you're looking for that cross-platform piece, and if you want to build an app one way and get that piece, then MonoTouch is the way to go for you. But again, just like Brad said, it's not about necessarily the language, but more about the platform itself. And learning about the platform is learning that Cocoa Touch framework.
So clearly, you'll have to learn the Cocoa stuff, you know, either which way. You know, one example on the productivity side from my, you know, 1 hour of messing around with Objective-C on the iPhone platform is, you know, going back to the whole, you got the separate .h files where you got to put stuff in the .h files and stuff in the source files. And it seemed like there's a lot of ceremony involved with sort of the older style development sort of model that you get with Objective-C. Is it just something that I just need to get over? I mean, you just get used to that stuff and it's not that big a deal.
Well, I remember suggesting that maybe C# could use header files, and Brad Wilson looked at me like I was insane. maybe I never lived through the pain of header files in C and C++, but I didn't think it was that big a deal.
So I would agree that coming from C#, I did C++ back in the day, and I tried to flush that from my memory as much as I can. But that is a bit a bit painful. I mean, but it is what it is, the way it is, because you have the way the libraries work. So, you know, when I compile down to a library, I have a header file that I can give someone so they can get back to using my library. That's just the way the platform works on that side. And there's a lot of tools out there that actually, because a lot of Mac developers would agree with you that, man, I have to put both places, or if I'm going to define my property and then it's going to have, you know, I say at property retain, you know, and it's going to be a read-write property, and then I won't have to go and synthesize that property in my M file. Well, there's actually some pretty cool productivity tools to help you do that. There's a, I think it's called Accessorizer, that will help you go in and actually do, put the all a lot of that kind of same monotonous kind of code that you have to type over and over again in all your pieces into it. And also, there's actually text templates inside of Cocoa that you can create text templates that expand into multiple parts, and you can use, you know, once you understand using Xcode, it becomes actually quite easier to get that productivity back. I'm going to go out on a limb and say you'll never get as much productivity as you have in Visual Studio today, but eventually you'll probably be on par.
So there's only one other reason I can think you might want to stick with MonoTouch, and that's just recent news that that the Mono guys were talking about having the Mono runtime run on Android. So it could be possible to basically write your app logic in one assembly and then split out your views into a MonoTouch view and an Android view, perhaps, unless they, you know, pull some more magic out of their hat and unify the API so that you just write to, you know, a Mono view, and it figures out whether you're compiling for, you know, Cocoa Touch or MonoTouch or Android, either one.
You know, every time I see tools like that that sort of promise the idea of just have one view and it shows up in the right place in the right way, I'm just unhappy, because you really want to use the native stuff on the platform. You can definitely tell when an application has been ported from Windows to the Mac or something like that. And I think it would show the lowest common denominator if you wrote your app that way. So I think at least targeting the views, if not necessarily the application logic to each display device, seems like the appropriate thing to do, and, you know, leave the magic home.
Well, I think everyone here can probably recognize Java icons when they see them and start up an EXE. Oh, look, it's Java.
Well, I was actually saying that I think the quintessential thing is that it's not just the phone itself. I mean, you talk about the new Droid that's coming out from Verizon. You're talking about a bigger screen. You're talking about, you know, more pixels on the screen. You know, how would you actually create a view that, you know, I might have the same controller logic, but how am I going to get the view to line up right and be the same thing? I mean, it's like Brad said, you've got, you know, I open up iTunes on the Windows and I went, wow, they didn't write this for this platform. You know.
It's that one pixel border, isn't it? Bothers you. It's a sign of a true Mac dev.
I saw the lack of one pixel border in iOS 9, by the way. And the reason you can see it on Windows and not on the Mac is because on the Mac, when a window's in the foreground, it has a drop shadow behind it that's provided by the OS. And you don't have that in Windows. And it's just really obnoxious to see no, like literally no border. The white from iTunes bleeding over to the white of Notepad behind it just drove me insane.
John's just waiting for Moonlight on the iPhone, and then he'll get into it.
Yes.
Did you see they announced webcam capture on Moonlight now?
Those guys are insane.
Nice.
Yeah. Is Kay Scott there? We got to have a token question.
Somebody wake him up.
I'll just paste in a question from an old show.
I still work with some people that like to develop starting with the database, and they'll basically say things like what Scott Kuhn was saying earlier, which isn't necessarily how I see the world, but I can appreciate their viewpoint.
Did you guys see the new Silverlight user voice site?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just waiting to see how long it takes the Mono team to like work their way through that. The top five Silverlight requests.
Start working their way through it. They have to wait around, though. They have to wait for the .NET guys to catch up a little bit. They're still waiting on the C# REPL.
Well, sort of. But they kind of jump ahead, but then they're like in Silverlight, there's some areas too where they still have some catching up to do. Silverlight versus Moonlight.
Yeah, still the installation. I think I had trouble installing Moonlight on my Ubuntu system. I couldn't it downloaded and then I couldn't get Mozilla to recognize the XPI. It was bizarre. It was the kind of problems you have under Linux.
Yeah.
If I can't apt-get it and have it just all work, then it's going to be a pain. Okay, well, anything else you guys can think of? Any other pain points?
There are no pain points. only good points. And I actually blame Brad for everything.
It's all Brad's fault. Well, we're gonna spend an hour talking about Object Builder, but they started to grab torches and pitchforks. do you guys want to plug anything? Have you done anything cool, Brad? You don't do much, do you, Brad?
I'm a developer. I do lots. It's the PMs that don't. Oh, no, I can't do that. They're going to be lining up at my door and killing me. So I'm on the ASP.NET team now and working on MVC2, which has got lots of cool stuff. But since this is not about ASP.NET or MVC, then, you know, that's my plug.
Yeah, we kind of beat that horse with Phil, I think.
Yeah, I figured.
We did. We talked about areas and we talked about the validation. Those were the two things you did or worked on, wasn't it? The areas and validation.
Actually, I didn't work on areas. Worked on areas. I ended up working on the templates and the validation and model metadata stuff. So I had a few blog posts come out this week, and I'm going to do a few more talking about how the template stuff all works. It's kind of like a feature we half-hearted stole from dynamic data for web forms in a very MVC-like way, where you can sort of dynamically display objects without thinking too much about what it takes to show them and edit them. So it's a pretty cool feature.
So I've been working lately, mainly this past week. The reason I'm up here is because we're doing an Azure deep dive. So we're putting some applications out in the cloud, doing MVC apps, putting them out in the cloud, and doing some iPhone apps that will talk out to the cloud, the big Azure cloud, the amazing Azure cloud. Have I sold you yet?
Jay Scott woke up.
Poor guy.
You know, I got to tell the story. We Scott and I, it's Jim Newkirk, used to play, God, what game is that?
Rainbow
Six Vegas. So we used to play Rainbow Six Vegas on the Xbox 360, and Jim would be at his house, and Scott would be at his house, and I'd be here when we were all living here in Washington. And there was this one time when we're all going on the mission, and Scott just stands there at the beginning of the map. And I'm like, what's going on? Did he go to the bathroom? He didn't tell us. So we go out, we're doing a mission. All of a sudden I hear through the headphones, Scott's asleep while we finish the mission. That was so awesome. And then we died. And he's sitting back there and we can't recycle the mission because he's still sitting there alive. Asleep.
Okay, well, should I say that wraps it up?
Yes, please.
That wraps it up. We'll see you next time. And look, we don't have to, like, take out anything that's NDA'd.
I know. It's awesome.
as far as we know. I don't know. Maybe what Brad is working on in the MVC 2 is
right.
Not allowed.
It's all using NS namespaces. That's the innovation. The
name. NS validation? What? No, it returns an NS validation context, which then has a set of NS validated objects that you have to iterate over.
And it stores them in a plist.
Have you actually been looking at our API? That's pretty close to it.
Yes.
Can we also make sure that we when we say Scott, we don't just say Scott?
That's a very good idea. So we will say, like, out of the group, we'll say Scott K and K Scott. So you could be, I don't know if you want to be Scott D or.
That's great.
Or, okay.
You can call me anything you want. Just, you know, don't just go say Scott because I will get completely confused.
How about Sergeant, Sergeant Densmore?
Aye, aye, sir.
I was thinking Snookums. We'll just call him Snookums.
Okay. All right.